From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, as the cycle of violence continues in the Middle East, we talk with an Israeli and a Palestinian. Each has written a reflective memoir that sheds light on the larger conflict. We'll hear from Raja Shahadeh, a Palestinian human rights lawyer and author of Strangers in the House, Coming of Age in Occupied Palestine. And we'll hear from Israeli journalist Yossi Klein Halevi. His latest memoir is about his efforts to understand Christians and Muslims in the Middle East, but years before he began this interfaith dialogue, he was a member of an extremist Jewish group. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. A federal judge in Virginia has refused bail for the American captured with the Taliban in Afghanistan. John Walker Lind is accused of conspiring to kill Americans. Lawyers for Lind had asked that the 20-year-old Californian be released to the custody of his father. The judge said Lind is a flight risk. The U.S. military says it has released all 27 prisoners taken in a raid last month in Afghanistan. NPR's Steve Inskeep reports from Kandahar.
Authorities made arrangements to fly the prisoners back to the remote village where the U.S. and its Afghan allies captured them. Special operations soldiers struck two buildings where armed men had been living. The U.S. initially believed that both were hideouts for Al-Qaeda, then later suggested that Taliban supporters were there. Residents contended that the targets of the attack were loyal to Afghanistan's new government. One building was a local government office, and the other was the headquarters of a disarmament commission. Provincial officials say 18 people died in the attack. Residents claimed that the 27 prisoners included the local police commander, politicians, and even six common criminals pulled out of the local jail. In recent days, Pentagon officials suggested that at least a few of the prisoners had Taliban ties. Steve Inskeep, NPR News, Kandahar, Afghanistan.
Vice President Dick Cheney is scheduled to visit the Middle East in the next few weeks. Cheney's office said the vice president will visit Israel and eight other countries over 6 or 8 days. The announcement came as the Bush administration looks for ways to get the peace process underway again. Secretary of State Colin Powell criticized Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat today, saying Arafat very well might have known about an attempt to smuggle weapons into the Palestinian area. President Bush is in New York today promoting his defense budget proposals. Andrea Bernstein reports from member station WNYC.
The president hasn't always been on good terms with this city, which historically tilts Democratic. But he was greeted today with a poll showing almost two-thirds of the city's residents approve of the job he's doing.
A vital part of our economy and economic growth is to have a vibrant New York City. And so the $20 billion is coming. A lot of it's already come. There's more to come.
White House Budget Director Mitch Daniels seemed to be backing off that pledge earlier this week when he called New Yorkers money-grubbing and said the $5 billion victim aid fund would be part of the $20 billion. But Daniels since apologized, and the president said Daniels now understands the $20 billion commitment. Before leaving town, the president is expected to raise $2 million for Republican Governor George Pataki's re-election campaign. For NPR News, I'm Andrea Bernstein with the president in New York.
In stocks today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 32 points to close at 9,653 in heavy trading of more than 1.6 billion shares. The Nasdaq lost 25, or 1.4%. This is NPR News. Bank officials in Ireland say they want to talk to one of their foreign exchange dealers who's suspected of defrauding allied Irish banks of about $750 million. They say the suspected fraud took place at Allfirst Bank, an Irish bank subsidiary in Baltimore. The CEO of Allfirst identified the missing trader as John Rusnak of Baltimore, saying he hasn't shown up at work since last week. Rusnak's lawyer said today that his client didn't steal any money and that he hasn't gone into hiding. Britain's Queen Elizabeth reached a milestone today, marking 50 years as monarch on the anniversary of the death of her father, King George VI. NPR's Julie McCarthy reports from London.
The Queen's father succumbed to complications from lung cancer in 1952, and at the age of 25, she assumed the crown. The Queen broke with her tradition of privately commemorating her accession to the throne and visited cancer patients at a hospital. Her black Rolls-Royce swept up to the Macmillan Cancer Center to waves and applause from some 50 well-wishers. A 41-gun salute in London's Hyde Park was followed by a 62-gun salute from the Tower of London. Golden Jubilee celebrations planned for later this year have gotten off to a slow start, prompting a flurry of denials from the palace about public apathy. Recent polls show strong support for the Queen, who, despite the antics of her children, is seen as a hard-working monarch. Julie McCarthy, NPR News, London.
New Hampshire Governor Jean Shaheen announced today that she'll challenge Republican Bob Smith for his Senate seat. Shaheen, a Democrat, is serving her third two-year term as New Hampshire's governor. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, maker of natural vitamin E, ADM, the nature of what's to come, on the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Israelis and Palestinians are living in fear as the cycle of violence continues and the prospect of peace seems to be receding. We're going to hear from a Palestinian and an Israeli who have each written reflective memoirs that shed light on the larger conflict. Later we'll hear from Yossi Klein Halevi, who writes about Israel for the Jerusalem Report and the New Republic. My first guest is Raja Shahadeh, a human rights lawyer in Ramallah on the West Bank. He's a founder of the human rights organization Al-Haq, an affiliate of the International Commission of Jurists. His new memoir is called Strangers in the House, Coming of Age in Occupied Palestine. His family is from Jaffa, the old Arab city adjoining Tel Aviv. In 1948, during fighting between Arabs and Jews, the family fled the city and went to a summer home in Ramallah. 3 weeks later, the State of Israel was declared, and Jaffa was included in the new state. The Shahada family remained in Ramallah. Raja was born in Ramallah 3 years after his family moved there. It was occupied by Israeli forces after the 1967 war. In Shahada's memoir, he writes about growing up with what he describes as the incessant, angry roar of people expelled from their homes.
What made the expulsion more difficult was the speed in which it happened and the fact that they felt they were taken by surprise and they were cheated out of their homes. For years we lived with this feeling that they should have stayed, maybe should have fought more, maybe should have responded differently. The effect on me was that I always felt that our reality was not Ramallah, it was Jaffa. And the people who held the keys to that reality, to that lost world, were my parents. So to a large extent, I was a hostage to a world which I also felt was too imperiled to be taken for granted. It was held together by their words, their descriptions, their memories, their reminiscences. And so I wasn't free to live in my own world. It was always that this world was not good enough. One example of what this led to is it took me a very long time before I came to appreciate the beauty of the surroundings in Ramallah. The Ramallah hills are extremely attractive hills, but I always followed my father in his gaze, which went beyond the hills and looked to the horizon, to Jaffa. So it really was a very long time before I finally was able to look at my surroundings and decide for myself, where is my place? What are my feelings? And rather than feel a hostage to the reality of others.
Now, your father was a lawyer who became politically active. When the family moved to Ramallah, it was part of Jordan and remained that way till 1967. Your father got into trouble with the Jordanian government when he represented three of the men accused of assassinating the king of Jordan. He also ran for the Jordanian parliament. He lost. He was imprisoned twice by the Jordanian government. What taste did this leave in your mouth about politics, watching your father become, you know, an enemy, perceived as an enemy of the government?
I grew up in two worlds, the world of my mother, which was the world of the house, and the world of my father, which was the world of the outside. And I was a weak child, so I was constantly pampered and stayed home, and I was more comfortable in the world of the house, in the world of my mother. And my father's world seemed an antagonistic world, a violent world, and I grew up thinking the worst of politics. The book, of course, is a memoir of my relationship with my father, and he was a person who could not see something wrong and not do something about it. He was an activist who was a man of principle, so he didn't calculate whether defending these people in that assassination trial would be a good thing or a bad thing. He thought, I'm a lawyer, my duty is to defend criminals, and I'm going to do it. He was that kind of a person. The effect on me was not so much political, except to the extent that it made me think the worst of politics. It was more emotional. So, for example, when the army came knocking at our door to pick my father up and take him to prison, that was a very frightening experience. And to this day, when people knock at the door in a loud way, I get very rattled, even when I know it's a friendly caller.
Your father said that he was considered a traitor by a lot of Palestinians and other Arab leaders because he was challenging the accepted wisdom of Arab leaders. What are some of the things he was challenging? How did his politics depart?
Well, he thought along with everybody else until 1967. He didn't really challenge the basic positions. And in 1967, he had a great change. Just after the war, he felt very depressed and, in fact, considered committing suicide. And my mother stopped him at the last minute. And then, immediately after the war, he had a change of mind about the whole situation. He realized that the Arab states keep promising that they will wage war and that they will do great things. And every time time comes for the war, we don't see any Arab soldiers and we have to fend for ourselves. And I describe in the book the events of the 1967 war and how miserable it was and how unprotected we felt. So in 1967, he thought enough is enough and Israel is a reality. He believed that it was in the interest of the Arab countries to keep Israel as an abstraction, a monolithic enemy which has which is used to quell people into submission and to keep them thinking about outside rather than about what needs to be done within their own country.
So in other words, that if Arab leaders could keep Israel as an outside threat, it would keep the pressure off the Arab leaders to reform the country,
yes,
from within, because the dissidents would be arguing about Israel instead of arguing with their own leaders.
Yeah, this he felt very strongly, and he also felt that Israel, in fact, of course, has taken our land, has not compensated us and so on, but it is a reality which we have to come to terms with. And he made a proposal in 1967, which is very, very early on, where he proposed a two-state solution. And he believed that there has to be a partition of geographic Palestine between a Palestinian state and an Israeli state along the 67 borders, which included, of course, East Jerusalem as the capital.
Your father was denounced on a Palestinian broadcast from Damascus. And you quote the broadcast. The people said about your father, "You are a traitor, a despicable collaborator. You want to surrender and sell our birthrights. We know how to deal with the likes of you. You shall pay for your treason. We shall eliminate you, silence you forever. Traitor, collaborator." I'm wondering what it was like for you and for your father to hear him denounced as the enemy when, I mean, he was denounced by Palestinians as the enemy. And he was Palestinian. You're from a Palestinian family. So what was it like to be perceived by fellow Palestinians as the enemy?
It was a very difficult time for me. And it was difficult because I was not a political person. I didn't really formulate my own positions on any of these issues. I was taken along with my father from the early days of the occupation to go into the 48 areas of Israel and to see for myself Jaffa and to meet with his Israeli friends and get exposed in a way that none of my colleagues and friends were exposed. And he, of course, was constantly arguing that we have made mistakes, that we have to correct them, and we should not continue to allow others to determine our fate. And as far as my understanding went, I believed him, and I thought he was saying absolutely the right things. And then all of a sudden, I hear this strong denunciation. Also, amongst my friends, there is a lot of popularity for the resistance movement outside. And as you can imagine, somebody, I was 16 at that time, the attraction of guerrilla warfare and fighting the enemy rather than accepting things or being so rational about it was maybe more typical for somebody of that age. So I was literally torn. But again, I didn't take political sides because I wasn't a political person. It was entirely emotional.
You went to college because you loved literature and wanted to study literature, but you ended up studying law as well, and you became a lawyer. When you, after your studies, returned to Ramallah in 1976, you were the first Western-educated lawyer to come back to the West Bank since 1948. Why did you go back?
This is a very important question, really, because all my life, and I suppose the culmination of this is this book. All my life, I've been trying to come to terms with my father, and he was the ideal which I could not feel fulfilled or feel that I'm living in reality if I avoided. I thought it would have been very easy for me to make an academic career. I was very successful in my academic studies, but it would have felt a betrayal. It would have felt that it is not a real life. And my sense of what was real was my father's life, just as my sense of what was real was Jaffa more than Ramallah. I had to come back in a profession which my father would respect and work with him and come to terms with him. So I wanted to be with him. I wanted to come back. But I was sure I wasn't going to come back on his terms. I was going to be my own lawyer, my own style of lawyer. I was going to do human rights because I believe in the principle. I'm going to write, and I continue to write all along. And, of course, all of this created great conflicts between us because he said, oh, you're too distracted between your human rights work and your writing. You don't have enough time for the office. You're not being a good lawyer. And we had huge fights, which I think were unfair on his part, but they were part of the tension between us.
Now, in 1987... You say you embraced the Intifada and that you were really changed by the Intifada. Why did you embrace it? Because you had been, in your mind, not political, certainly for human rights, but not politically active, and you were always alienated by politics, more living more in your own mind, living more in literature than in that kind of political activism.
You know, somebody of my personality and character can never be a man of the people, can never really be a public person. I'm too individualistic to be anything of that sort. So when the Intifada started, it was my first experience of feeling that my struggle, my personal struggle, and the public struggle were at one. And it felt very good. Because for the first time, I was working with everybody. Because, you know, the first Intifada was different from the present Intifada in the sense that the whole community was threatened by an occupying army who were right amongst us, not in the peripheries, as is the case now. And so there was a lot of solidarity work. There was a lot of coming together to work on collective things against the occupation. And for a change, I felt myself, I was not withdrawing. I was not holding back. I was going along and feeling at one and feeling that this time we are going to win. And then, of course, some people would say, but how can we win against Israel? And I would say, if we believe in it, we will win. This is our war of liberation. So it was an entirely new experience, maybe more of a political experience than I've ever felt or ever will feel.
Now, you described that first Intifada, the one that started in 87, as the general rebellion of sons against their fathers. What do you mean by that?
You know, it was a very optimistic, romantic maybe time when we felt that we were going to change the way things were. We're going to change the educational system, create new legal system, create new relationships. Of course, this meant great difficulties for the fathers because the sons, the children, were feeling so empowered by this wave that Teachers at schools were finding it very difficult to control students. Fathers at home were finding it very difficult to control their sons. But for me, as always, being the kind of person I am, there was also the sense that I was finally proving my father wrong, because I was participating in a common action which was going to get us somewhere, and that was the way to do it. And his cynicism about the possibility of something like this ever happening was going to be proven wrong, because it was happening.
And that's another sense that you saw it as a rebellion of sons against fathers.
Exactly.
It was a general rebellion
and also a personal rebellion.
My guest is Palestinian human rights lawyer Raja Shahadeh. His new memoir is called Strangers in the House, Coming of Age in Occupied Palestine. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Raja Shahadeh, and he's just written a memoir called Strangers in the House, Coming of Age in Occupied Palestine. He's a human rights lawyer in Ramallah. His father was a very political lawyer. In 1991, you joined the Palestinians at the Middle East Peace Conference as the Palestinian legal advisor. So here you are, going from human rights lawyer to really entering the political process. That was over 10 years ago, and things have just totally fallen apart. I'm wondering how your work in the early 90s with the peace process left you feeling then, and then we'll get to how you're feeling now.
Well, it didn't take very long for me, because I stayed for 1 year with the negotiating team, and after the year I decided that I'm not going to have any ability to influence anything. I felt there was something happening somewhere else. I didn't know what that was. I wasn't sure of anything. But I was sure that I'm not going to be effective in Washington. And I took myself and went back to Ramallah. It was exactly a year after I had started. And I stayed away. And then in 1993, sure enough, I discovered that there were secret negotiations taking place while the negotiating delegation was in Washington. And then I discovered that they had made an agreement between the PLO and Israel. And my doubts were proven correct. There was something cooking.
Why did you feel like you had no influence?
Because I understood exactly the Israeli position. I had been following since 1978 the Israeli changes in the occupied territories, which I saw will culminate in an agreement if Israel would have its way, and culminate in an agreement that would be bad for us, because it would confirm all the ills of occupation without breaking through into something that would lead us to peace. And the main problem, of course, was the Israeli settlements. But, you know, the Israeli settlements is a political issue, but it had translated into a very definite legal arrangement, which gave two systems, legal and administrative, to the Israeli settlers in the West Bank and the Palestinians, who lived side by side, subject to two different systems. I saw that being established year after year, slowly being built up. I saw it, I wrote about it, I tried to warn people that this is going to lead to disaster. And when the negotiations began, I saw that it was my role to point out that if we allow Israel to confirm the system, then we will have no peace in the area. And when I realized that what I was talking about was not accepted, was not being understood, much as I tried, however I tried, I thought I cannot do any more. I left.
So the first intifada was a real turning point for you. It politicized you. You felt for the first time a part of a larger movement. What about the current intifada? Do you feel connected to that at all?
No, the current intifada is very different, because it's a militarized intifada. And you know, in the first intifada, we all felt we had something to say. We were able to carry on with our narrative, so to speak, that even if one was not political, you responded to what the political statements said, and you felt they were speaking for you. Whereas now the violence has silenced everybody, and interestingly enough, this is true on both sides, the Israeli side and the Palestinian side. The violence has just silenced everybody.
What do you mean it has silenced everybody?
Well, every time there is a violent action, one doesn't feel able to say anything. You're so overwhelmed by the shock and the brutality and the sadness that there's nothing to say.
It seems that many, perhaps even most, Israelis have lost their faith in Arafat as a partner for peace. And I'm wondering if you think that Palestinians have lost faith in Arafat.
Well, the Palestinians have been disappointed in many ways by the Palestinian Authority, which came into being as a result of the Oslo. The work of human rights organizations, mine and others, and the work of people who worked on democracy issues, bore some fruit, because people really were expecting that once we get the chance, we will have a system which would have accountability, which would have more equality, more of the Western type relations democratic relations that we had come to aspire for, and interpret our struggle as leading us to. They were disappointed on many such counts. The problem, though, is that the Palestinian Authority and Arafat as an elected leader of that authority came as a result of a political process and an agreement which was signed between Israel and the PLO. What Israel is trying to do in ousting Arafat is forgetting about or unilaterally destroying the agreement. I, as a lawyer and as a Palestinian living there, have great trepidation from the legal vacuum that will be created as a result. If there is to be change, it has to be done properly and carefully rather than unilaterally by Israel. Otherwise, I have great fear that we would be in a legal vacuum. And a legal vacuum for the weaker side would be a disaster, because then Israel would have a free hand to do what it would like.
Raja Shahadeh is the author of the memoir Strangers in the House, Coming of Age in Occupied Palestine. We'll hear more from him and from an Israeli writer in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. And by Bantam Books, a division of Random House, publisher of Lay That Trumpet in Our Hands by Susan Carol McCarthy, a novel set in Florida during the Civil Rights Movement. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our conversation with Palestinian human rights lawyer Raja Shahadeh, and we talk with Yossi Klein Halevi. He writes about Israel for the New Republic and the Jerusalem Report. His recent memoir is subtitled A Jew's Search for God with Christians and Muslims in the Holy Land.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Raja Shahadeh. He's a human rights lawyer in Ramallah on the West Bank. His new memoir is called Strangers in the House, Coming of Age in Occupied Palestine. As a human rights activist and lawyer, what are your reactions when there are Palestinian attacks on civilians in Israel at shopping centers? A recent attack at a girl's bar mitzvah, a religious ceremony. What do you think about when that happens?
It's extremely shocking thing to happen. Extremely shocking thing to happen. When you and I don't know in this country if you're shown the details, but Israeli television are very explicit in what they show. It just makes one's life miserable. But at the same time, it makes my life miserable to realize that there are people on my side, people who I see in the street who have come to the point of such despair about the future that they are willing to shatter their body into a million pieces because they have no hope, no future. At the same time, I was always alarmed by how the Israeli missiles had hit Palestinian children and Palestinians in a car, and their bodies also shattered. And there were children who were shown on television, on one of the satellite televisions, also picking the flesh of these shattered bodies. And the next day, there was an attack in Israel. So it's as though it's a cycle. One tragedy leads to another. It's whoever does it, it is unacceptable, morally unacceptable, and politically bringing us to disaster.
You write in your memoir that you had heard all these things about Israel and heard all these things about Jewish people, but you'd never really met anybody Jewish until, I guess it was 1967, when the Israeli troops came in during the occupation. And that was your first and for a while your only exposure with people who were Jewish. I'm wondering if you've met a lot of Jewish people from Israel or other parts of the world, and what it's been like for you to meet with or perhaps even to work with people who had been really demonized from everything that you'd heard and you'd never had any encounters of your own before.
You know, the assumption from the outside, from what all that you see, is that the two societies are very separated. It may be true now because of the present intifada and of the imposition of all these closures on the Palestinian towns and villages, but the country was never divided from 1967 until the early 90s. Anybody could take their car and drive anywhere in Palestine, Israel. All kinds of people had relations. Businessmen had relations. Workers had relations. Farmers had relations. Merchants had relations. So many people, and of course there were these very unfortunate relations of people who were taken into prison and learned Hebrew in prison and got to know their jailers, one kind of experience, of course. The number of people who, for example, speak Hebrew, who've seen and learned and had an opportunity to intermingle with the Israeli society is tremendous. And of course, there are more similarities than there are differences. So there were great possibilities for one to learn about the other. And had the Israelis had the wisdom, the prudence, they could have used the Palestinians and what they've learned about the Israelis as a bridge to the rest of the Arab world. Unfortunately, they were more interested in acquiring this land and keeping it than in making bridges of peace. And people speak about coexistence now between Palestinians and Israelis. Well, you can't have coexistence when every day you look out of your window and you see a settlement right next to your house, which has been built on land that has been taken from you or from your family or from your friends. And the spring of water is used by the settlers. And you have to bring in your water in a tanker. I mean, you can't possibly have coexistence on such inequality.
Raja Shahadeh, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Raja Shahadeh is the author of Strangers in the House, Coming of Age in Occupied Palestine. He's a human rights lawyer in Ramallah. We'll hear from Israeli journalist Yossi Klein Halevi after a break. This is Fresh Air. We just heard from Palestinian human rights lawyer Raja Shahadeh. My guest Yossi Klein Halevi is the Israeli correspondent for The New Republic and a senior writer for The Jerusalem Report. His latest book is a memoir called At the Entrance to the Garden of Eden, A Jew's Search for God with Christians and Muslims in the Holy Land. He's also chairman of Open House, an Israeli-Arab dialogue group. But many years before he began this kind of dialogue, he was a member of a Jewish extremist group. Halevi grew up in Brooklyn, New York, the son of a Holocaust survivor. He moved to Israel 20 years ago. I spoke with him yesterday. He was in a studio in Jerusalem. Right before we started this interview, you told me you were hearing a lot of ambulances going by. Is this typical, and what goes through your mind as you're sitting in the studio talking with me, listening to ambulances going by?
Well, I feel like I'm listening to your question with one ear and counting ambulances mentally with the other ear. And that's what we've become, a society here that counts ambulances. One ambulance, we wait for the second. If there's a second ambulance and then a third, we turn on the news. And especially these days in Jerusalem, I think we've now crossed that line from being a city that occasionally is inflicted with terrorism to being a city at war. And that's really what it feels like now.
How has life in your neighborhood changed?
I live in a border neighborhood, which is to say at the very edge of Jerusalem. In fact, my apartment is in the last row of houses before the West Bank begins. From my porch, I can in effect see three countries. There's Israel, there's the West Bank, and then there's Jordan. And I'd say that sense of intimacy has become increasingly threatening in the last year. What was once for me at least, an exhilarating feeling of cultural, even interreligious intimacy, has now become a daily threat.
Do you know any victims of the recent terrorist attacks in Israel?
Well, my 12-year-old son went to baseball camp. We have that here too, with a boy who was murdered, apparently by Palestinian shepherds in the Judean desert, and this boy was mutilated so badly that they couldn't identify him except through his fingerprints. And I was trying to shield the paper that morning from my son. And he found the paper, and he looks at the picture, and he says, "Oh, my God, it's Kobe." So, and I was shielding the paper from him not because I thought he knew Kobe. I didn't know he did. I just didn't want him to start the day with that news. And then when it turned out he actually knew the boy, it was just one of those devastating moments that we've had more and more of here. And my own children, I have three, have been in so many close calls in the last few months that my wife and I have simply stopped counting.
When you were a teenager in the 1970s growing up in Brooklyn, New York, you were drawn to the Jewish Defense League, which was then headed by Meir Kahane. This is a militant, ultra-Orthodox group that was extreme in its hatred of all Palestinians and violent as well. Your issue was freeing Soviet Jewry, and you say your activism was limited to vandalism. But you had friends who were indicted for bombings and shooting attacks on Soviet institutions in America. Does that help you comprehend the Palestinian terrorist attacks on Israel?
If you're asking me whether I understand the mentality of terrorism, yes, I do understand it. I grew up in the Jewish ghetto in Brooklyn, a child of Holocaust survivors. And my worldview was formed, or I should say deformed, by a sense of us versus them. There was us and there was the rest of the world. which was either actively or passively against the Jews. It took me many years to learn to overcome that simplistic way of looking at the world. Terrorism is an outgrowth of fear, of self-righteousness, of being able to only understand or appreciate your own pain and not the pain of others. To explain or understand Palestinian terrorism today, to my mind, is no different than if I were sitting here now and trying to justify the kinds of terrorism that my friends were involved in and that Meir Kahana preached. Meir Kahana and Yasser Arafat belong in the same boat.
You've said that your group believed in the 70s that Jewish victimization granted you moral immunity. Can you talk about that a little bit?
You can't be a terrorist without believing that you have the right, because of your pain, because of the trauma your people has gone through, to inflict unlimited pain on others in the name of your own people's cause. You're dealing here in the Middle East conflict with two traumatized peoples, two peoples who've been victims of history. And on the Israeli side, the great success of Zionism, I would say, of Jewish sovereignty, has been to largely free us, and here I certainly include myself in this, to largely free us of a victim-dominated identity. It was only once I moved to Israel in 1982, left Brooklyn, left the diaspora, that I began to see myself in a more nuanced way and to see the Jewish situation in Israel in a more nuanced way, because we weren't victims. Jewish sovereignty had empowered us. The tragedy on the Palestinian side is, for understandable reasons, they haven't yet experienced sovereignty, but they haven't been able to take the opportunities that have repeatedly come their way in the course of the last 50, 60 years, beginning with the Peel Commission in 1937 through the UN partition in 1947 to Camp David and Taba in our time. If you see yourself only as a victim, you don't feel the power to take responsibility for making compromises. If I'm the victim, then my responsibility is simply to sit back and wait for more concessions.
Your father was a Holocaust survivor, and you grew up in Borough Park, Brooklyn, which is a neighborhood that was mostly comprised of Orthodox Jews, many of whom were Holocaust survivors. Was it that sense of being descended from a Holocaust survivor that helped give you that sense of victim?
Oh, absolutely. That's where it came from. And I was so immersed in my victimization that I didn't realize that I was growing up in the freest country in history, in the most secure Jewish community in history. I lived with demons. I was, in some sense, trying to become a surrogate contemporary of my father's. I was living out his life rather than living out mine.
Last year, you had a book that was published called At the Entrance to the Garden of Eden, A Jew's Search for God with Christians and Muslims in the Holy Land. This book was the result of, I don't know, 2 or 3 years of you traveling through the Middle East, trying to understand Islam and Christianity, going to a lot of churches and mosques, participating in services there. What motivated that search?
By the time I began this journey in late 1998, by that time it was clear that the Oslo process had failed. And one of the reasons I felt that it had failed was because it was trying to create an artificial peace between secularized elites on the Jewish side and on the Palestinian side, ignoring the deep reservoir of religious sentiment among both peoples. I wanted to do something that, so far as I know, had hardly been tried, and that was to see whether we could pray and meditate together. That part of the journey, I believe, succeeded. By the end of this journey, I felt thoroughly at home in a church, in the presence of a cross, which is traumatic for probably most Jews, whether they admit it or not. And in some ways, even more important for me as an Israeli, I learned to feel at home in a mosque. To overcome that primal dread that Israelis feel toward the mosque was one of the main goals for me on this journey. A very simple goal, but very, very difficult. And for me, it happened in, of all places, a mosque in a Gaza refugee camp. In fact, the same refugee camp where I had once patrolled as a soldier 8 years earlier and had been hit in the head with a rock, in fact, almost adjacent to this mosque. And it so happened through a series of connections that the sheikh there was willing to welcome me in. And I learned Muslim prayer. I learned to get on my knees and to pray with my kippah, clear as a religious Jew, but joining that Muslim prayer line, learning to truly love Islam, to experience the total immersion of the body, that choreographed prayer that's the genius of Islam, and to experience that in Gaza. So whether this book is a footnote or whether it's a promise for the future, I don't know. But I can certainly say that since the outbreak of the Second Intifada, that part of the journey feels very remote.
You've written that the journalist and the spiritual seeker within you are at war.
Right. The job of the journalist is to chronicle what is, what exists. And what exists at this point in the Middle East is despair. The job of the spiritual seeker is to try to imagine what could be and what he believes on some level actually is, which is human oneness, and to keep trying to strive to that place of oneness. And I have to tell you, in all honesty, I don't think I've done a very good job maintaining the balance. I think this Second Intifada has been so devastating, so demoralizing in terms of what it says about the ability of the Palestinian leadership to negotiate for the sake of peace. I would argue 70% of Israelis would have been prepared to accept almost any compromise. What exists in Israel today as the hard core, the hard line, is not more than 30%, the settlers and their supporters. But the tragedy of this intifada is that Arafat has pushed most of us back right into the arms of the hardliners, and Israel today is a society in despair.
My guest is Israeli journalist Yossi Klein Halevi. He's the Israeli correspondent for The New Republic and a senior writer for The Jerusalem Report. His latest book is a memoir called At the Entrance to the Garden of Eden, A Jew's Search for God with Christians and Muslims in the Holy Land. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Yossi Klein Halevi, Israeli correspondent for The New Republic and a senior writer for The Jerusalem Report. Over 100 Israeli reservists have signed a petition saying that they refuse to serve in the West Bank or Gaza because Israel, the Israeli army, is systematically humiliating the Palestinian population there. What was your reaction to this petition? And I should mention here that you served in Gaza with the Israeli military during the first intifada in the late 80s.
I did, and my experience in Gaza in the late 80s was of being part of an occupation that could only enforce its will through a constant series of petty humiliations. That is how an occupation works. And for many years, we Israelis were deluding ourselves by imagining that we could create what we called a benign occupation. Now, I imagine there are different kinds of occupation. We, on the whole, I don't believe that we were guilty of atrocities, but in some sense, we were guilty of something worse, which is this constant stream of humiliations and really falling into a pattern where humiliation becomes part of one's reality. And that, in some ways, is the most destructive pattern of all. So that I emerged from that first intifada and my experience as a soldier in Gaza, convinced that we have to do everything we can to end the occupation. And that's why I came out of there, along with the Israeli mainstream, voted for Yitzhak Rabin. The night he won the election, I wept with relief. I said, at least now this nightmare may be coming to an end. But what we discovered in the course of Oslo, which we initiated, we empowered Arafat, we brought him back here, we put police uniforms on his terrorists and tried to turn them into allies against terrorism. What we discovered was that sometimes the cure is worse than the illness. And what the Oslo process has done is empower an entity that is, in its essence, committed to terrorism and worse than that, to the destruction long-term, to undermining the legitimacy of Israel. And at this point, what we need to do, as painful as it is to say this, is simply wait Arafat out, protect ourselves as much as possible from the terrorist war that's been declared against us, and at the same time, seek alternative partners on the Palestinian side, which Sharon may be doing or may not be doing now. No one knows exactly what these negotiations are really about that Sharon has initiated with Abu Ala, Abu Mazen, and several others. And to what we're seeing now with the reservists is it's so insignificant compared to the enormity of the ideological collapse of the Israeli left over the past year, that to my mind that's the real story, and to come out with that kind of a declaration strikes most of us. And here I'm not only referring to right-wing Israelis, I'm referring to Israelis like myself who are in the center, or even many Israelis on the left, who are appalled at what the reservists have done. We are a country at war in exactly the way that you over there have been at war since September 11th. And I imagine that American society would react to if you had a draft, would react to that kind of moral squeamishness with the same impatience and anger that most of us here have reacted to the reservists.
Well, one last question. Our interview started with you hearing a lot of sirens going by and wondering what was happening, ambulance sirens. So when the interview ends, what are you going to do?
First thing I'll do is make a call back to my wife and see if she's heard any news, if everyone is home. I know that my son was wandering around downtown, so that's the first thing on my mind. And, you know, I wrote this book, I went on this journey, and now I'm living in a very different reality. And to tell you the truth, there are times when I have to actually sit down and reread parts of my book to remember how exhilarating it was to pray in a mosque, to meditate with nuns in a convent. And to connect with that sense of human oneness and human potential. And if there's any message that I feel that I can still try to hold on to, and admittedly it's very difficult for me, it's that we religious people have a responsibility to continue to make sure that religion isn't abused and that God's name isn't taken in vain for hatred, for violence. And if I'm speaking this way, then I think at this point, the onus is on the Palestinian side to start rethinking some very basic premises. And the first premise to rethink is the Palestinian tendency to dismiss any legitimacy for Israel's existence. And what we learned in the First Intifada, and I certainly include myself in this, was that we, the Israeli side, had committed injustice in this 100-year war. And we learned that the Palestinian side has a case. They have a legitimate case. In this second intifada, the onus is on the Palestinians to learn the same lesson about us. We have a case. We are a legitimate presence in the Middle East. We're not colonialists. We're not invaders. We are native sons. We belong to the Middle East. And until the Arab world, not just the Palestinians, until the Arab world makes its peace with the legitimacy of our existence, then the tragedy in the Middle East is just going to continue.
Well, Yossi Klein Halevi, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Yossi Klein Halevi is the Israeli correspondent for The New Republic and a senior writer for The Jerusalem Report. His recent memoir is called At the Entrance to the Garden of Eden, A Jew's Search for God with Christians and Muslims in the Holy Land. Earlier, we heard from Palestinian human rights lawyer Raja Shahadeh. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Megan Howell, Patty Leswing, and Jessica Chu. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, promoting excellence in journalism worldwide and investing in the vitality of 26 U.S. communities. This is NPR, National Public Radio. On the next Fresh Air, Greg Mortensen, founder of a group that organizes schools for girls in Pakistan and Afghanistan. And we call Andrew Meldrum, who reports for The Guardian from Zimbabwe, where new laws restrict journalists and outlaw criticism of the president, Robert Mugabe. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.